Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Pride 2016 edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, clips from the aftermath of the Pulse Massacre, plus some history of Stonewall, the Rainbow Flag, and we end on a musical note for a change. Let's begin episode 345.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Happy Pride, everyone. This week we have a special theme, Pride.
Like, duh.
We're going to start with a clip from Dan Savage, in the wake of the Pulse Massacre in Florida, who reminds us that this was not the first and likely not the last attack on the LGBT community, but progress is being made. Let's listen in.
This wasn't the first attack on a gay bar. Some bigoted monster planted a nail bomb in a pub in London in the 90s. A madman tried to set fire to a gay bar in Seattle on New Year's Eve, 2014. A madman, another arsonist, set fire to a gay bar in New Orleans in the 70s, and 30 people died. There have been other attacks. There will be attacks in the future, because there is, and it seems there always will be, hate targeting the lesbian, gay, bi, and trans community. And we need to confront that hate. There's a couple of things we need to confront. Guns, again, guns, access to guns. The killer in Orlando used the same weapon that the killer used in that grade school in Sandy Hook and that the killers used in that office park in San Bernardino. An assault weapon. We need to bring back. We used to have a ban on assault weapons. We need to bring back the ban on assault weapons. We need to make it harder for people to get their hands on weapons designed to mow down as many human beings as possible in the shortest amount of time possible with the least amount of effort possible. And we need to confront and we need to hold people accountable for the toxic, murderous homophobia and transphobia that is continuously pumped into our culture. And the main source, the wellspring of that toxic homophobia and transphobia is religion. Not all religions, not all faith leaders. I can hear the Nults running to their keyboards. We're not all like that. We know you're not all like that. But you know what? Enough of you, people of faith, are like that to keep this toxic homophobia and transphobia in play, to keep it deadly, to keep it lethal. And so we need to confront that. We need to argue with people about their theology, which is something I used to say maybe we should try to avoid. Okay, we're going to go to hell. That's fine. You can think that. Let us live our lives and God can sort it out. And if you're right, you win. But the price of not confronting people about their theology is obviously too great. The Orlando sheriff on CNN shortly after the shootings, murders, said, "We call on members of the clergy to pray for us, to pray for this community, to pray for healing. We, lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people everywhere, we call on members of the clergy, imams, priests, rabbis, pastors, to examine your own hands for evidence of blood. Because this kind of murderous homophobia, it doesn't come from nowhere. The killer's father was on television saying that his son was angered and may have been motivated to commit these crimes, this crime, this series of crimes, these 50 murders, after seeing two men kiss in Miami in front of his three-year-old son. Because how do you explain to a three-year-old two men kissing? I guarantee you that that three-year-old had no problem with two men kissing. I guarantee it was not an issue for that three-year-old. Because that three-year-old had not yet lived on this earth long enough to be poisoned by homophobia, which is pushed by who? By what? And to what end? And when will it end? And how many have to die before it ends? And how many atrocities must there be? How many attacks on gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people will there be before we, and by we I don't just mean queer people, I mean all good and decent people, stand up to the homophobes and the bigots and no longer allow them to hide behind their pulpits, their quote-unquote sincerely held religious beliefs, their Leviticus quotes, their Quranic quotes, their paper-thin, literally paper-thin, justifications for hatred and bigotry. A lot of screaming and yelling on Twitter that liberals want to talk about guns, conservatives want to talk about Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. We can talk about both things. We can talk about religious bigotry, and we can talk about our poisonous, toxic gun culture. And religious bigotry against LGBT people isn't unique to Islam. Ted Cruz, Bobby Jindal, and Mike Huckabee all spoke at a faith event and were brought on stage by the host of that event, a Christian pastor, immediately after he called for the extermination, for the deaths of gay people, of all gay Americans. So this isn't unique to Islam, but you see evidence of it everywhere, justifications for it everywhere. You see a justification for it when the Pope, cool Pope Francis, gave a speech, made remarks about the shooting in Orlando and couldn't bring himself to acknowledge who the victims of that shooting were. We have refuges now. Gay bars, historically, were always refuges for queer people. And we have refuge now in places that 40 years ago, 35 years ago when I was coming out, we never expected that we would ever have. We can find a refuge, many of us, in our families of origin, in our workplaces, with our straight colleagues, in our communities. Gay bars aren't the only place we can find refuge. But gay bars and nightclubs like Pulse, like The Cuff in Seattle, like Roscoe's, and Sidetracks in Chicago, like The Eagle and G in New York, like Pulse in Orlando, still places of refuge. And clearly still necessary and needed places of refuge. Unfortunately, not impenetrable places, not completely safe places, because the doors are open. The doors at Pulse, like the doors at Rebar, where I met Terry, open to all. It's June. This attack came in June. June is Gay Pride Month. June is the month the communities all across the United States host gay pride parades, celebrate LGBT life. And Pride, of course, commemorates an attack on a gay bar on the Stonewall Inn in New York City in 1969 that sparked the gay revolution, modern LGBT civil rights movement. But that attack on that gay bar, that attack on Stonewall, that lit a fuse that changed the world. And here we are, June, and an attack on a gay bar. And one of the key differences in these attacks, if you're looking for the silver lining, is the attack on Stonewall, on the Stonewall Inn in the Village of New York City in 1969. It was an attack by the authorities. The cops burst into that bar to arrest the patrons who fought back. And this weekend, in Orlando at Pulse, a gay bar under attack, And this time the cops, they burst in not to arrest the patrons, but to attempt to save them. We will always live in a world with bigots. The measure of a society is not, is it free of homophobia, transphobia, anti-Semitism, racism, sexism? The test is, how does that society respond when racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, anti-Semitism, when those things manifest themselves, how does that society respond? Deadly, deadly form of homophobia manifested itself in Orlando this weekend. And you can see a measure of progress, as painful as it is at this moment, to even acknowledge progress in the response of good people, the response of the President of the United States, the response of the authorities. If any good is going to come of this, in the same way that something good and transformative came of the Stonewall riots, the attack on Stonewall, let it be this attack also serving as a catalyst. Stonewall inspired lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people all over the country and all over the world to come out, to fight, to demand change, to demand the respect and love of their families and their communities and their nations. Let us bury the dead. Let us mourn, and then let us come out of this attack making demands. A demand for an end to gun violence, a demand for sensible and sane gun control, and a demand for an end to homophobia and to transphobia, and a demand for accountability for those who promote it, whether they're promoting it in a church or a mosque, so make a plan, or a legislature. It has to end, and it has to end now. Stonewall ended the closet. Let Pulse end the tolerance for bigotry.
Tolerance or violence in the whole world goes to war is one enough or is one too many before we say no more? Could you ever love?
One of the things you hear, what we hear a lot, is those who express solidarity with the community in times like last month's attack on Pulse nightclub. It's often referred to as a gay nightclub, but the club, as far as buildings go, as far as I know, are asexual. Yes, a majority of the patrons were of the LGBTQ community, but cisgens were welcome. Our places are and will likely always be welcoming to anyone, irrespective of your lifestyle. Sadly, this is not always the case in the reverse, and this is especially true in the southern United States. This is why this next clip is poignant. This is Barbara Hare's angry response to, quote, thoughts and prayers of the intolerant after Orlando massacre. This is going to be some pretty strong stuff, so you've been warned.
Our hearts and our prayers and our thoughts go out to the victims and the families and blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm going to read something for you that I did not write. But it was posted on my wall, and I think it is exactly what most of us are feeling and thinking with this. And I'm going to curb some of the words because it is a little strong. So I say to all those politicians with their thoughts and prayers, screw your thoughts. Screw your thoughts and prayers. We don't need them. I certainly don't want them. You cannot elevate people like Kim Davis and Ted Cruz and Huckabee and Ann Coulter and Donald Trump and then as a country turn around to pretend that it's Islam that caused this. We have been beaten to death with fists and boots and bottles and bats and lead pipes. We have been shot and stabbed and mutilated. We have been raped to death, and then we have been raped again just for the fun of it. We have been trapped and burned alive, and families are too ashamed to claim our corpses. Church is refusing us a decent burial. We have been strangled and stuffed under motel mattresses. We have been hung from barbed wire fences and left alone to die slowly. America, you have done all of this to us while calling us the predators. How dare you? America, your politicians have fractured our bones under the heels of their shoes, and their footprints have tracked our blood all the way to the airport bathrooms and clandestine hotel rooms where they seek pleasurable release from people like me. How dare you, America, use our suffering and our corpses as a shield to attack 1.6 billion people? How dare you pretend that suddenly, just today, you care for our safety while you do nothing about the reckless greed of gun manufacturers, do nothing about the people in power who mock us and encourage fear of us? How dare you, America, try to use the fear that I live with every single day of my life, every threat, every attack, every slur that has been screamed at me, every bit of rage hurled at me by men who wanted my number in a gay bar, or men who courted me to demand to know how I or my boyfriends taste, every bit of shame from the pulpit on Sundays in church, every time I had to hear as Dobson said my queerness should be beaten out of me, every time I gripped my own hand a little bit tighter to walk past the protesters outside of a gay pride rally. How dare you try to take this fear that you have installed in me and redirect it towards your war? How dare you? America, you have been at war with me since before I was born. I am not your scapegoat. You are not actually angry on my behalf. And you do not get to twist my anguish to fuel yet more hatred and yet more death. So take your thoughts and take your prayers and turn them towards yourself. Because they won't help me, but maybe, perhaps, they'll help you realize that we've been dying all this time and you never gave a shit before. Thank you.
Next, we have sort of a recast of sorts about the power others have over us and how a simple glance can change the way you feel about yourself. Let's listen in.
Hello, my name is Panty, and for the benefit of the visually impaired or the incredibly naive, I am a drag queen. I am also a performer of sorts, and an accidental and occasional gay rights activist. As you may have already gathered, I am also painfully middle class. My father was a country vet. I went to a nice school, and afterwards I went to that most middle class of institutions, an art college. And although this may surprise some of you, I have always found gainful employment in my chosen field, gender discombobulation. So, the kind of grinding, abject poverty that we saw so powerfully on stage tonight is something that I can thankfully say I have no experience of. But I do know a little something about oppression, or at least oppression is something that I can relate to. Now, I am not, of course, for a minute going to compare my situation to Dublin workers in 1913, but I do know what it feels like to be put in your place. Have any of you ever been standing at a pedestrian crossing when a car goes by and in it are a bunch of lads, and they lean out the window as they go by and shout, "Fag," and throw a milk carton at you? Now, it doesn't really hurt. I mean, after all, it's just a wet carton, and in many ways, they're right. I am a fag. So it doesn't hurt, but it feels oppressive. And when it really does hurt is afterwards, because it's afterwards that then I wonder and worry and obsess over what was it about me? I mean, what did they see in me? What was it that gave me away? And I hate myself for wondering that. It feels oppressive, and the next time that I'm standing at a pedestrian crossing, I hate myself for it, but I check myself to see what is it about me that gives the gay away, and I check myself to make sure that I'm not doing it this time. Have any of you ever come home in the evening and turned on the television, and there is a panel of people, you know, nice people, respectable people, smart people, the kind of people who probably make good neighborly neighbors, the kind of people who write for newspapers, and they're all sitting around and they are having a reasoned debate on the television, a reasoned debate about you, about what kind of person you are, about whether or not you're capable of being a good parent, about whether you want to destroy marriage, about whether or not you're safe around children, about, you know, whether or not God herself thinks you're an abomination, about whether, in fact, maybe you are intrinsically disordered. And even the nice TV presenter lady that you feel is like almost a friend because you see her being nice on TV all the time, even she thinks it's perfectly okay that they're all having this reasoned debate about you and about who you are and about what rights you deserve or don't deserve. And that feels oppressive. Have you ever been on a crowded train with one of your best gay friends and inside a tiny part of you is cringing because he is being so gay? And you find yourself trying to compensate for his gayness by butching up a little, or by trying to steer the conversation onto safer, straighter territory. And this is you who has spent the last 35 years of your life trying to be the best gay possible. And yet there is still this small part of you that is embarrassed by his gayness. And I hate myself for that, and that feels oppressive. And when I am standing at a pedestrian bloody light, I am checking myself. Have you ever gone into your favorite neighborhood cafe with the paper that you buy every day, and you open it up, and inside is a 500-word opinion written by a nice middle-class woman, the kind of woman who probably gives to charity, the kind of woman who you would be totally happy to leave your children with? And she is arguing over 500 words so reasonably about whether or not you should be treated less than everybody else, about arguing that you should be given fewer rights than everybody else. And when you read that, and then the woman at the next table gets up and excuses herself to squeeze by you and smiles at you, and you smile back and nod and say, no problem, and inside you wonder to yourself, does she think that about me too? And that feels oppressive. And you go outside and you stand at the pedestrian crossing and you check yourself, and I hate myself for that. Have you ever turned on the computer and you see videos of people who are just like you in countries that are far away and countries that are not far away at all, and they are being imprisoned and beaten and tortured and murdered and executed because they are just like you? And that feels oppressive. 3 weeks ago, I was on the television and I said that I believe that people who actively campaign for gay people to be treated less or treated differently are, in my gay opinion, homophobic. Now, some people who actively campaign for gay people to be treated less under the law, took great exception to that characterization, and they threatened legal action against me and RTE. Now, RTE, in its wisdom, decided incredibly quickly to hand over a huge sum of money to make it all go away. I haven't been quite so lucky. And for the last 3 weeks, I have been lectured to by heterosexual people about what homophobia is and about who is allowed to identify it. Straight people have lined up ministers, senators, barristers, journalists have lined up to tell me what homophobia is and to tell me what I am allowed to feel oppressed by. People who have never experienced homophobia in their lives, people who have never checked themselves at a pedestrian crossing, have told me that unless I am being thrown into prison or herded onto a cattle truck, then it is not homophobia. And that feels oppressive. And so now, Irish gay people, we find ourselves in this ludicrous situation where we are not only not allowed to say publicly what we feel oppressed by, we're not even allowed to think it, because the very definition, our definition, has been disallowed by our betters. And for the last 3 weeks, I've been denounced from the floor of the Oireachtas to newspaper columns to the seething morass of internet commentary, denounced for using hate speech because I dare to use the word homophobia. And a jumped-up queer like me should know that the word homophobia is no longer available to gay people, which is a spectacular and neat Orwellian trick, because now it turns out that gay people are not the victims of homophobia. Homophobes are the victims of homophobia. That it's not true, because I don't hate you. I do, it is true, believe that almost all of you are probably homophobes. But I'm a homophobe. I mean, it would be incredible if we weren't. I mean, to grow up in a society that is overwhelmingly and stiflingly homophobic and to somehow escape unscathed would be miraculous. So I don't hate you because you're homophobes. I actually admire you. I admire you because most of you are only a bit homophobic. And to be honest, considering the circumstances, that is pretty good going. But I do sometimes hate myself. I hate myself because I fucking check myself when standing at pedestrian crossings. And sometimes I hate you for doing that to me. But not right now. Right now, I like you all very much for giving me a few moments of your time, and for that, I thank you.
Let's take a moment to digest that, and we'll be back after this message.
Hi, you're listening to CITR. My name is Paula, and this is Pride Facts. I'm talking about legislative discrimination against LGBTQ plus people around the world. 73 countries criminalize same-sex activity through legislation. The terminology and the corresponding laws ranges from indecency, buggery, and immorality to against nature. Penalties can be as severe as life imprisonment. So-called propaganda and morality laws that target freedom of expression related to sexual orientation apply to 17 states. The most striking fact might be that in 10 countries around the world, homosexuality carries the death penalty. In contrast, 76 countries and 85 entities have anti-discriminatory laws that protect people of any sexual orientation. All this information is derived from a paper called State-Sponsored Homophobia 2016, a world survey of sexual orientation laws, criminalization, protection, and recognition. Get educated. Happy Pride, everyone. Hi, you're listening to CITR. My name is Paula, and this is Pride Facts. Five words for you. Words that have been reclaimed by the LGBTQ plus community. Reclaiming language is taking words that have been used to degrade a community and turning the meaning around. Taking away the negative connotation of the words can be liberating. Let's take a closer look at the word queer and its history. Originally, it was used in 16th century Scotland to mean peculiar or eccentric. Contemporary synonyms of the word are odd, unusual, strange. The word, used as a term towards the LGBTQ plus community in the late 19th century, was reclaimed in the 1990s by a New York-based group of activists named Queer Nation. Their aim was to take the word out of violators' mouth and give it a positive connotation by self-identifying as queer. The famous slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," was coined by the group. The word queer is still considered offensive by some members of the LGBTQ community. Many feel uncomfortable using a word that caused them so much harm. Why use it then? Advocates for the usage of the word queer use it as an adequate umbrella term for LGBTQ+. It is considered inclusive of all sexual orientations and non-binary, unlike the terms lesbian or gay. Queer your vocabulary up by checking out the following web pages: positivespace.ubc.ca/terminology, www.glad.org/reference/transgender, www.autostraddle.com. Check out the series More Than Words. They discuss queer words. Happy Pride, everyone.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada, your pride-powered skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. Now, for some, Stonewall won't mean that much. But for those of us in the community, it's our Rosa Parks moment. It's the I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore moment. Together, let's find out what Stonewall was and why it was a watershed event for the gay community.
Hey guys, welcome to Hip Hugh's History, where I'm gonna get all gay on ya. Not in a creepy way. We're gonna take a look in this episode at the 1969 Stonewall riots. But first, we're gonna hopscotch a little bit through the beginning of the 20th century so we can find out what's going on. There's not too much gay history in American history prior to World War I, mainly because everything is so closeted and secretive. But we do, in 1912, have an incident called the Portland Vice Scandal, which occurred in Portland, Oregon, when a young man who was arrested for shoplifting seemed to blame a couple golden gay men on what he had done. And bada boom, bada bing, the next thing you know, we have a forced sexual sterilization bill in Portland. So if you were caught being gay, they would sexually sterilize you. In the 1920s, we have Harvard University creating secret courts to out gay professors and gay students and expel them and fire them from their jobs. And in World War I, the U.S. Army created what was called the Blue Discharge, which, because there was no rule that you couldn't be gay, this was a way of getting rid of gay soldiers. And the Blue Discharge were used in both World War I and World War II. And actually, the GI Bill specifically eliminated people that had blue discharges from receiving any kind of benefits from the GI Bill. In the Roaring Twenties, we actually have kind of a flourishing of gay culture because everything was kind of pushed under the ground because of Prohibition. So you have speakeasies in major cities that are making it easier for gays to get together, to drink, to dance, to do those types of things because the police don't know what's going on. And then in 1924, we have the first gay society. It's a temporary gay society called the Society for Human Rights that was founded by Henry Gerber in Illinois. They actually produced a couple pamphlets called Friendship and Freedom, and that lasted for about a month before somebody turned them in for being gay, and they all got arrested. And then really, after World War II, we have the explosion of the Red Scare, and homosexuals are being included on these lists with communists because they are thought to be more susceptible to blackmail. But there certainly is also an anti-gay discriminatory thing going on there. The FBI, police, the State Department, even the post office is tracking anybody thought to be a suspected homosexual and keeping their names. And between 1947 and 1950, there were over 4,000 discharges from the U.S. Army for people being gay, and over 400 state employees, government employees, that were fired from their jobs for being gay. So this brings us to right around 1950, and I think it's time that we got a real organization. Pioneers of the gay rights movement is Harry Hay. Harry Hay in 1950 created the Mattachine Society. And you'll notice a lot of these groups, including the lesbian group that was founded around the same time, the Daughters of Bilitis, the DOB. They're not including gay and lesbian in their names because they're trying to kind of keep it subversive. There was actually, it was almost like a Mason society where you would have levels of secrecy, and the higher you got up in leadership, the more that you would be informed. But everything is on the up and up. They're actually battling stereotypes. They don't like the idea of queens and cross-dressers and transgender peoples because it's kind of filling in that stereotype where they want to portray themselves as dresses and suits and ties and kind of all this stuff. And in 1965, the Mattachine Society in D.C. under Frank Kearney staged the first gay protest in the United States. There's a picture of it right there. And you can see that they're in dresses and they're in suits and they're acting very normal. But even people in the Mattachine Society were outraged when they saw these people protesting because they didn't think that putting it in people's faces was the best way to get any movement on that. We also have the American Psychiatric Association in 1952 putting homosexuality on a list of mental diseases. And the study that they used to make that declaration was on a study of mental patients who were gay. So, if you take a lot of mental patients that are gay, you'll probably find out that they're mental patients. Actually, Evelyn Hooker, a psychiatrist, did her own study in 1956, released it to the American Psychiatric Association, that showed that there was no difference in mental deficiencies between heterosexuals and homosexuals. But the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, is going to keep homosexuality on a list of diseases from 1952 to 1973. We have a little bit of movement in the Supreme Court. The first Supreme Court gay case is One Inc. versus Olson in 1958 that involved a magazine called One, kind of gay publication that was being sent through the mail that the United States Postal Service was refusing to deliver. And they won that case. And it's kind of a landmark victory because now they can communicate through mail. That's a big deal because they can start to network and create larger organizations. In 1966, we have our first real act of civil disobedience that doesn't get a lot of press. It's called the Compton Cafeteria Riots. And this is mainly the transgender community, but the police in Compton went into this restaurant where the workers had called them because these people were being gay and they wanted to be served. And one of the transgender women threw a cup of coffee in one of the cops' face. And the next thing you know, there was a melee and chaos and they were ripping things up and burning things up. But Compton's cafeteria didn't spread. It didn't get enough publicity. And this is going to prime us for Greenwich Village, 1969. So Greenwich Village is kind of in the heart of rebel territory, right? This is where the beatniks made their path. And you have gay beatniks like William Burrow and Allen Ginsberg, who are openly writing about homosexuality in the 1950s. But in the early 1960s, the mayor of New York City, Robert Wagner, actually began cracking down pretty hardcore on a lot of these bars that were serving gays. And it's important to understand that these aren't gay-owned bars. The mob owns these bars. But because it's the 1964 World Fair coming up and Wagner wants to clean up the city, they are basically entrapping people, they are throwing people in jail left and right in order to clean up the city. And even when Mayor John Lindsay was elected and he promised to stop all of that harassment, the New York State Liquor Authority still was going after bars serving gays because they claimed that they couldn't give a license to any bar that was disorderly. And because homosexuals considered to be disorderly, they weren't going to serve them. This led to the 1966 Julius Sip-In. The Mattachine Society in 1966 sent three guys into the Julius. They announced, "We are homosexuals and we would like to be served." And you can see the bartender right there covering up their drinks. So there are people trying to get attention. It's not radical. It's almost in the spirit of the civil rights, nonviolence kind of methodology, but it's not gaining traction. So this brings us to the late 1960s and the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street, which is a mob bar. It was owned by the Genovese family, and everybody knew it as the gay bar in the city. But it didn't have a liquor license. They washed their glasses in a tub in the back. The toilets were overflowing. There were no fire exits. And they were paying off police every week to keep themselves open. And even by paying the police off, they were still getting raided once a month. But they were being tipped off by the police. So the raids were almost like a, you know, kind of formal event that everybody knew about. But there's a lot of reasons why people think that the police went to close down the Stonewall on June 28, 1969. But the theory that I keep hearing over and over is that the mob was making more money on blackmailing the patrons of the Stonewall Inn, like stockbrokers and stuff, and they weren't ready to give kickbacks to the police. So the police kind of had enough with the Genovese family. So they made an unannounced raid on June 28, 1969 at about 1:20 in the morning. There were about 205 people at the Stonewall, and the way that the raids would normally work is there was a peephole. You couldn't get into the bar unless the bouncer saw you, recognized you, some kind of idea that you were gay. But the police just announced they were police and they rammed that door down. And the way they usually did it was they would line everybody up, and if you had ID, they would let you go. And if you didn't have ID, or if you were a woman wearing man's clothes or a man wearing women's clothes, you were going to get arrested. But for some reason, things didn't go smoothly that night. There's claims that the cops were sexually harassing some of the lesbians, touching them inappropriately. Some of the transgender women in the bar started to kind of talk back. Men were refusing to show their ID, and because some of the patrol wagons hadn't arrived yet, they were lining people up, and there were like 100, 150 people lined up, and there were about 200 or 300 people in the crowd outside that was growing. And this is a spontaneous event. This was not planned. So there's a lot of reasons why it probably happened. People were probably just bottled up with anger and frustration, and this was the opportunity. But there was a lesbian named Storme Delavarie, who, when she was arrested and she was going back out to the car, she shouted to the crowd, "Why don't you guys do something?" And that was the trigger. And suddenly the place erupted. Coins and stones started getting thrown at the cops. The cops started backing up from these, you know, mob of 200 and 300 gay people. They pushed them back into the bar. The police had to retreat, and they grabbed a couple people they had arrested, including David Van Ronk, the famous folk singer, who's not gay, but because he's a member of the kind of the beat community and the anti-police protest community, he's there. And suddenly he's in the bar with about 10 cops, trapped as this mob outside tries to get in. They're breaking windows, they're burning garbage and sticking it into the windows, and they eventually pulled a meter off the ground and they use it as a battering ram to break the door down. So now that they're backed up in the bar, the TPF arrives, the Tactical Police Force, because it's now like a full-blown riot. And the story is that the transgender women lined the streets as the TPF came, and they started doing the Rockefeller kick line, yelling, "We are the Stonewall Girls. We wear our hair in curls. We don't wear underwear. We show our pubic hair." The cops probably didn't like that, and that's when they took out the batons and they started beating heads. And it's kind of the geography that allowed this riot to happen, or, you know, the building patterns. There's tons of, like, crooked alleyways and places to hide. But from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock that morning, it was like Keystone Cops. They're running around trying to arrest people. There's hundreds, maybe 1,000 people now that are rioting and burning and turning police cars over. And at about 4 in the morning, it quieted it down. But the next night, people started arriving early. They were graffitiing the walls next to the Stonewall with terms of gay pride. And that night, the cops came out in force again, and they had another riot for about 4 hours, chasing people around and confrontations and people getting beat up. It rained the next couple days. That was a Monday and Tuesday. There was a small event where the Village Voice had printed an anti-gay kind of, you know, slant on that story, and about 1,000 people showed up at the Village Voice offices threatening to burn them down. And then that Wednesday night, there was one more night of riots, and really, that's it. Gay people after that, at least in that area, are not going to go back into the closet. And after Stonewall, we start getting the first organizations with gay in their titles, like the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Association, that are going to now take a very more aggressive role in trying to change the tide of anti-gay discrimination in the United States. They would zap people. They would show up in reporters' faces and ask them questions about, you know, gay rights and such like that. But really what's going to make this memorable is a year later, and that's June 28th, 1970, where we have the first gay pride parade in New York City, and then by the next year, it's spreading across the country, and really, now we have a gay rights movement. Like it or not!
Now that we know the history, let's hear from the people who were actually there and fought for this equality. Let's listen in.
The Stonewall Bar, to me, is a terrible place where something great happened. The swinging 60s were a time of public revolt and political action. Many marginalized groups were making great strides. Many, except for one.
In many states, people could be incarcerated as a sexual psychopath the minute it was known you were homosexual.
You had no legitimate right to really even exist as gay people.
So there was no place where you could be sure at the beginning of the night that you wouldn't suffer an attack during the night. During that period, beating up gays was a national sport.
It was actually against the law to serve an open homosexual at a bar. It was against the law.
Gay New Yorkers could at least gather at the Stonewall Inn.
It was a seedy bar. It was run by the mafia. They only opened it to make money for off of gay people, to exploit gay people.
It was the best bar at the time. And of course you could dance, the music was great. We just didn't have things like that.
The bar was dirty, it was unpleasant.
Jukebox was great, and the drag queens controlled that.
Police raids on Stonewall were often and routine until one night.
On Friday night, June 27, 1969, the New York police force pulled off its biggest raid ever on the Stonewall Inn. They immediately ran into resistance from the transvestites who were mouthing off to them, saying things like, I have my civil rights too, don't touch me, get your hands off me.
A friend called Jerry to tell him about the raid.
His exact words were, Miss Hughes is right at Stonewall, get down here right now.
The angry crowd pelted the police with bottles and rocks.
And as we kept pushing them backwards, they were laughing nervously, but it seemed to get more serious, and we pushed them back into the bar.
The police were stunned. I mean, those were the riot police at a gay bar, unheard of.
There were thousands of people involved out in the streets opposing the police. Nothing like that had ever happened before.
And then this one queen, Miss New Orleans, was very skinny. She was so outraged, she started grabbing a meter and almost single-handedly tore the meter out of the street. And then these queens use it as a battering ram. This is what shocked me. And I said, my God.
The definitive turning point came when a lesbian had been inside the bar and was being roughed up by the police as they took her out of the bar into a patrol wagon. She also said to the onlooker, she says, why don't you guys do something?
And then everything went crazy.
The crowd erupted into an on-again, off-again fight against the cops.
I got there about an hour after it started. The scene that I was focused on, which I'll never forget, was the famous line where all the drag queens were doing a Rockettes kick line, singing, we are the Stonewall girls, we wear our hair in curls.
We wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. When it comes to boys, we merely hypnotize. And that's when it, that was enough of that. The cops just got us.
Well, I said to myself, heaven has arrived.
The thing that was going through my head was good. Finally, why not?
I spent the whole rest of the night throwing rocks and making lame attempts at turning over cars, and it was a ball.
These were our sisters. They were all fighting, and I couldn't walk away. I didn't want to walk away.
I remember it being fabulous, or as I say, fabulous.
Gays fought back that night, I think, because of a string of assaults. It was building up.
It was the first time that most of us actually got to vent our anger.
From the fighting, a movement was born.
If it had just been those nights of rioting and outrage, and nothing followed it, nothing would have changed.
The first gay rights organizations were created after Stonewall.
We put on dances that were by and for the gay community. We built up a huge treasury. It was used to start the first gay community center.
A year after the riots, the group marked the occasion with a march.
We decided that the march should start around Stonewall on Christopher Street and march up to Central Park. We had threats. We were scared. We often referred to it as the first run, because we went so fast. By the time that we got to the park, and I turned around. It was unbelievable. It was one of the great moments of my life. I get chills just thinking about it, because in 1 year, we went from a bunch of hidden people who fought back one night in the dark to thousands of people marching in the sunlight into Central Park as proud, openly gay and lesbian people. When I die, that'll be one of the things I'm going to remember most.
And with those first steps, the modern Pride Parade began.
We've all seen the Pride flag, the rainbow flag, but where did it come from? What's its meaning? Let's listen and learn.
The gay pride flag is a really, really important part of LGBT history and LGBT culture. But how many of us actually know where it comes from? So today I'm going to give you guys a little lesson on LGBT history and tell you where that little flag originates. So to begin this story, we're going to jump back to New York City in the summer of 1969. At this time in our history, it was illegal for gay people to congregate and drink alcohol. So many gay bars were targeted by police raids, and many LGBT people suffered at the hands of police brutality. Nobody ever really fought back, until one night at the Stonewall Inn in New York City. Our community decided that they'd finally had enough, and a riot broke out that would go down in history as one of the most defining moments of the gay rights movement. Just a few days after these Stonewall riots, Judy Garland, one of the world's first gay icons, tragically passed away. It was the combination of these two events that made Somewhere Over the Rainbow one of the most iconic songs of the gay liberation movement. And it was a song that sang true in the hearts of every single person fighting for LGBT rights on the front line. It wasn't until almost 10 years later, in 1978, that an artist by the name of Gilbert Baker was asked to create a symbol for the Gay Freedom Day Parade in San Francisco. He was asked to create something that would inspire and unite LGBT plus people everywhere, and something that would send a bold message of love and camaraderie to everyone who saw it. During this time, protests for world peace were breaking out right across the globe, and the flag of the races was being flown as the symbol of unity for this movement. This sign of peace, diversity, and solidarity is said to have been what first captured Baker's imagination. And drawing further inspiration from Judy Garland's Somewhere Over the Rainbow and its vast importance to the LGBT community, the first ever rainbow flag was born. The first rainbow flag was a little different to the one that we know today. It consisted of 8 different colours which represented a different aspect of our diverse community. It was hand-stitched and dyed by 30 volunteers and flew for the first time in history over the Freedom Day Parade. It became instantly iconic and quickly became known as the flag of the LGBT people. But just a few months after we sent this bold and powerful message to the world, a tragedy shook our community as Supervisor Harvey Milk was assassinated. He was the first openly gay man to be elected into office and was one of the most powerful gay rights activists of our time. And so the tragedy of his death caused outrage amongst LGBT people right across America, and this caused the demand for the gay pride flag to soar. To meet this new demand, the Paramount Flag Company decided to remove pink from the flag to cut down costs, and opted for a more traditional rainbow design instead. And then just a few years later, the turquoise was also dropped from the design, leaving us with the rainbow flag that we know and love today. And then in 1994, on the rainbow flag's 25th anniversary, a giant flag was created in Florida that stretched over a mile long and connected the Atlantic Ocean with the Gulf Coast Sea. After this incredible demonstration, the rainbow flag was then cut up and sent to over 100 countries worldwide, truly cementing this as the global symbol of the LGBT people. Today, the rainbow flag still flies proudly above every single gay pride festival around the globe. And it can be seen flying outside pretty much any gay bar, club, cafe, or bookshop that you can find. It is a wonderful sign that LGBT plus people are welcome and safe, and is something that I look for when I visit any city around the world. So to you, little rainbow flag, and to all the people who fought for everything you stand for, I salute you.
That's about all the time we have this week. I'm going to close with a couple of iconic songs from the community. Judy Garland's Over the Rainbow and Queen's We Are the Champions. This is Dawn saying, eyes open, minds on.
Somewhere over the rainbow, drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you.
First, invent the universe. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sun.